Good Cyber Day. This is Peter May Rust speaking. I'm pleased to be talking in this conference, which Barry Hardy invited me to participate in several months ago. Since then, a lot has changed, and during this talk, I shall refer to some fairly recent developments. First, some technicalities. There are about 30 slides. They're down the left of your screen in HTML, and I shall name the single acronym which refers to each slide. So this slide's called Greetings, and the next one will be called Banal. Secondly, we give our talks in XML, HTML. For this conference and this conference only, we'll be using GIFs instead of the SVG, which we normally use and which we'd certainly urge you to have a look at. And finally, this talk is being recorded along with the HTML, and all of that material is open, and I shall be depositing it in our university repository, whose address is given there. It will be available to anybody for any purpose whatever, so long as they honour the provenance and the rights of the author under the Budapest Open Access Initiative. I'll be talking more about that later. So anyway, off we go. I'll be talking about open access, particularly in chemistry, with references to biosciences, and promoting its value. I hope to convince you by the end of the talk that this is something valuable and that you should be looking in that direction. I'll be telling you how chemical markup and some of the tools involved in it have contributed to making this a technical possibility. I'll look at some of the tools in detail, some of the things we can do, and then I will give some ideas as to where I think this is going in the future. So move to Bernal. About 40 years ago, J.D. Bernal, the crystallographer, had the prescience that we could have a complete information society. And you'll see at the bottom, he says that we need to get the best information from the people who are producing it to the people who want it, whether they know they want it or not. Next slide. And this is very much come to pass now in the semantic web. So Dan Connolly from the World Wide Web Consortium has said that computers make such a difference to what we do at the moment. If we were able to use computers properly, then much of what we do, which is tedious and error-prone, could be removed. So here I've given some ideas of what a chemical semantic web could do. So, for example, it's possible now to read JAMA Medicinal Chemistry, to extract the molecules from it, and to compute the geometries and energies. And we have the technology to do that. We've done it on RSC journals, but because of access rights to many journals, we're restricted from doing it, not by the technology, but by the legal protocols surrounding the dissemination of chemical information. So what we put there is actually correct. We can do it, but we're not allowed to do it. OpenProg. Definition of software is algorithms plus data. That was Nicholas Wirth many years ago. And I'm going to advocate that we have open programs. For open programs, we need open algorithms and open data. And we also need to add to it open specifications and clear metadata for the rights, telling us what we're able to do. Now, the problem is that in chemistry at the moment, we actually don't have a large percentage of anything open. Perhaps 1 or 2% of the software that most people use is fully open, and of the data available, we reckon that about 1% of data published in chemistry is available openly in electronic form. So we have a real problem if we're going to use modern ideas of information web, the grid, and so on, if we're dealing with chemical quantities, compounds, reactions, and so on. ChemPub. This is a schematic diagram of how chemistry is published. There are tens of thousands of chemists who write papers, send them to publishers. That's Pub 1 and Pub 2, goes into the publishers and comes out as a heterogeneous mix of isolated papers. So although there are 2 or 3 million compounds published each year, they will occur in literally tens, if not hundreds of thousands of different places. There's no central published database of chemistry. That's different from some other fields, like, let us say, astrophysics or geosciences, where very often the community collects data and publishes it in a database as part of the primary publication. But in chemistry, we have to read these isolated articles and then try and extract some meaning from the totality. Now, some of those are published as patents, and I'm going to say what the European Patent Office has done in, I think, a very innovative way. But the traditional way of aggregating chemistry is that secondary publishers will read the literature, and large numbers of humans will then retype the literature and put it into databases. And of course, this is an expensive process, so it, not unreasonably, they need to recover their costs. Unfortunately, this has several consequences. It leads to pub loss. So in this next slide, we see loss during publication. And we estimate that about 80% of chemical information, spectra, melting points, analytical data, stuff of that sort, is never published at all. Even though it's of high quality, it either sits in the departmental repository or more likely on people's laptops, and when the student or postdoc disappears, then it disappears as well. And even in pharmaceutical companies, and I spent a lot of my time in pharmaceutical companies, the capture of primary scientific data is pretty variable. So although we have electronic formats, you know, MOL, ChemDraw, things like that, when it's sent to a publisher, most of these are not allowed because it doesn't fit in with the publisher's model. And when the publisher then produces it, they produce PDF, which is essentially electronic paper, which contains really no useful reusable information for a machine. So the machine, designated by that little box under the humans, is actually unable to do anything with it at all. Now, the European, next slide shows typical, Christend shows typical current publication. You'll see here, I've taken it at random. The article is about crystal engineering, but you will see that it's still essentially transmitted in pen and ink, so that you can't rotate these pictures, you can't query them or anything. EPO1, this shows the European, this is from Gert Pavels in the European Patent Office, and many thanks for that. This is their slide, and it shows the broken nature of patent publication at the moment. So you'll see the patent applicant puts in a hand-drawn picture in some form. The Patents Office cannot read that by machine. They can't search a local database. And those broken arrows show that the whole process is broken. We'll come back to their new view in a minute. But let me say also a little bit about bioinf, bioinformatics, where we have already a large number of databases. These databases are linked. They're often deposited by author at the time of publication, so things like the PDB, SwissProt, and so on, where there's a requirement for journals to publish the supplementary scientific information. These are heavily curated, so that if you want to find data on a typical protein, say reverse transcriptase, you can go in and you can find out about its sequence, what gene produces it, what the HIV virus looks like, what the reaction catalyzed is, and so forth and so on, all sorts of stuff like that. In ChemInf, however, we don't have any of that. The informatics is closed. The providers of that information often don't let out the totality of the information they have, or if they do, there is a serious commercial charge for it. You can sometimes get dribs and drabs, the red dots at the top left, of the information. And also, those providers generally don't talk to each other. So you have isolated providers of chemical information, and they exercise, whether intentionally or not, what I call thought control. You can only access this information if you use their methods of accessing. You have to use their search tools, you have to accept the way their search runs, their depiction of chemistry properties, and so on. And although much of this is of high quality, it varies from provider to provider. So it stifles innovation. Individuals cannot get hold of this data, build their own tools to work with it, and come up with something which is an innovation on what's provided. And my view is that the closed nature of the chemical data and chemical software community is that it's holding back innovation in chemoinformatics. And this is being seen by many people. So if we go to EPO 2, we'll see the EPO's view of how chemical information should work in the future, and they're putting this into practice. So they're asking the patent application to be made in CML. You can see, you may not read it there, but those grey things are CML, and the patent office are producing an interface whereby the author applicant draws in their structure, and it's automatically translated to CML. This means that they, Route 2, have got the information on their own database. So as soon as compounds come in, they can search them automatically, knowing that the compounds are in electronic form. Similarly, they can put it out to the public, which is one of their necessarily roles, and also they can route it out to the database providers. Now, I don't need to explain to you that this changes the business model of the database providers. They cannot simply rely on a business model of typing up patents anymore. They have to be seen to adding significant extra value if they're going to continue to provide value to the community. So in No Loss, next slide, we see a model where everybody is potentially happy. If the author produces their material in XML, they can send it to the publisher, but they can also publish it to the web, where it can be harvested by open access harvesters. That's what OAI stands for. The publisher can send it to the reader in whatever form they like, including PDF. But also, if they publish it in XML, then the reader can convert it to their favored format, whether it be TeX or Word or HTML or whatever. Moreover, the publisher can also send the XML out to referees, and because it's in XML, it can be refereed not only by humans but by machines. And in fact, this is not a completely novel idea. The International Union of Crystallography has been doing it for many years. They don't use XML because they were ahead of it. They use their own SIF format. The authors author their paper in SIF, and the SIF is sent out not only to the referees but to programs which are able to check it for scientific validity, with the result that the crystal structures which go through this process are of considerably enhanced quality by the refereeing process. In contrast, many other disciplines, including chemistry, don't at the moment submit their papers to machine refereeing. Although we've developed at Cambridge technology for doing this, it's not mentioned in this publication, but we can read chemical papers and we can subject it to machine validation. So if we come on to threats, this really is the essence of what I want to get over, that electronic scientific data, if we don't wake up and do something about it, will be completely controlled or destroyed by commercial or quasi-commercial interests, and innovation and discourse will be stifled. The value that we have is that the web often allows us to work around things. We can replicate the data instantaneously, and I'm confident that some of the tools that we and others are developing them will be so spectacularly advanced on what is currently done that people will want to embrace the value of electronically enhanced publication, or what we call machine understandable scientific publications. I should differentiate machine understandable from purely machine readable. So we can protect this if we adopt the BOAI, next slide, the Budapest Open Access Initiative. And I would urge authors to add this to their data in their publications, make their data available so that then they are not bound in legal contract to whichever publisher they use, but that the data can be freely used by other scientists, copied, indexed, and so on. And where we have the legal ability to do that, it is making a very considerable difference to the way in which our scientific information can be managed. And you'll see some of that in the coming months. We'll be announcing some of that in a meeting in December at Cambridge. So, OpenChrist shows some of the things that we can do if the open information is robotically managed. You may be frightened of the idea that robots manage information rather than humans, but that's what is done on the web at the moment anyway. If you want a train timetable, that's managed by robots. You probably trust it. You probably trust many of the purchasing systems on the web. You know how to evaluate a good site from a bad site. And so what this does is give you access to the whole of the scientific literature, and you can decide which of it is of sufficient quality for yourself. Open source, next slide, tells you the background of some of the open source movement, Eric Raymond's Cathedral and Bazaar, and some of the open source tools. And these have been very successful in the computer science area of programs, operating systems, and so on. And many businesses are actually built on open source tools. That hasn't happened yet in science to such an extent, but I'm confident that we will start seeing that. Move on to OpenChem. There's not nearly so much chemistry is open, as I said, about 1%. And this lists some of the people and organizations that I'd like to thank here for making both the software and the data available. But in many cases, there are solutions in the open source area. And for those of you who have either the time or the financial ability to influence chemical software, can I make a plea to become more involved in the open chemistry project? So, under Mol Rights, we summarise the fact that we think that molecules should be openly published. And we've come out with a manifesto for open chemistry, which you'll see at the bottom is archived publicly in our institutional repository. So now I want to move on to CML. CML Central tells us about CML. This is quite a good time because CML is about 10 years old, and it's being widely adopted by the more open operations such as governments, patents, research organizations and so on, and academia. It's rather slow in the commercial sector, and this is a pity because we need the commercial sector on board, but there's been really relatively little interest in XML and interoperability from any of the major software producers in the chemical arena. This, of course, is not true in biosciences and in other neighboring disciplines where XML is absolutely standard. And I would urge any software manufacturers to consider the values of XML, particularly for interoperability. But hopefully that will happen over the next year or two as people see the value of it. But I would say that we do have enough experience and toolkits in CML that we're justified that it works and that it is technologically worth investing in. So next slide, CML, tells you a little bit about what CML does. It's fully compliant with the W3C's approach. It is built on a schema. It will adopt all of the approaches they come up with. So we will be introducing ontologies. We are introducing RSS. Henry will tell you about that. We're introducing every new relevant technology that the W3C comes up with. We had to build our own language for ordinary physical science. We call that STMML. So things like melting points are not really chemistry. They're a floating point number with a chemical interpretation. CML Core deals with molecules, atom bonds, and so on. CML React, which we're going to publish shortly, deals with a whole variety of reactions. CML Comp, which we announced the National eScience Institute in Edinburgh earlier this year, has been enthusiastically adopted by a number of groups, including the Daresbury Laboratories CCP1. CML SPECT is being developed at the moment, and CML CRISP is essentially being developed in conjunction with ACTA Crystallographica, International Union of Crystallography. I'm not going to go into the details very much, but the next few slides we'll skim through fairly quickly. The architecture of CML, CML ARC, shows those in an object-oriented form. But in fact, although one can build it like that, the next slide, schema menu, shows that CML is really a menu of different information components that one can use and reuse in different ways. So it's like a construction set. Depending on your cultural background, this might be Meccano, Fisher Technique, Tinker Toy, what have you. So you mix and match the various things there. And the smallest CML language need only contain molecule, atoms, and bonds, whereas something to cover computational reactions would involve both reaction scheme, the molecule group, eigenfunction, and some other things on the right-hand side. Now go on to STMML, a brief statement that we can support scalars, arrays, matrices, data types, units, and the linkage to a dictionary is particularly important. We'll see that later. CML0 gives a simple example of some CML. So in the middle, we show how nitrogen dioxide is constructed in CML, where the bond orders and the atoms with their hydrogen counts are precisely determined. And if you wanted to reflect the fact that it's got an unpaired electron, we have a spin multiplicity attribute for molecule, which would be 2. If we go on to CML00, I don't want to talk you through that, but simply to show that quite a complex piece of chemistry can be formally held in CML. Now, under ICHI, I want to say something about the IUPAC Unique Chemical Identifier, which is now called INCHI, I-N-C-H-I. This is a unique canonicalization of any molecule with a connection table, or indeed any molecule with a precise formula. And this shows NSC1, the first molecule in the NSC database. And you can see that it's got its formula, C7H6O2, and a unique labeling of the atoms and the bonds between them. And that is a unique string. It can be used to search that molecule, and we've built a database at Cambridge, and you can visit our site, where we've got 250,000 molecules, and the INCHI string for them will return it in a matter of tens of milliseconds. If we go on to properties, one of the key things that we have done is to label the properties that a molecule can possess. This model of a molecule possessing properties derives from Bahlstein some 130 years ago or more. A molecule has properties. The properties have citations. Each property has a property type, but you can have several measurements of a property, and it can therefore have several citations. And this is a very powerful and robust model which is built into CML. Under Props 1, here are some of the properties that Bahlstein, as an organization, now records. Now, the way in which we manage those properties is done with dictionaries, and you'll see those dictionaries in a minute. Just a word on how we're extending crystallography, CML to support crystallography. SIFSAC's DOM shows our extension of the W3C SACS and TOP and DOM technology to the SIF format. SACS was developed on XML Dev, the mailing list that Henry and I started up for XML. And that model is extremely powerful. It's in every XML distribution from any manufacturer, and it shows the value of the open approach. By running an open list and enthusing the community, we actually came up with a de facto standard, which is adopted and probably implemented in 100 million instances of software worldwide. So it shows the value of openness. If you have a closed model, you don't get this type of innovation and interoperability. In the next one, SIF to CML, we say something about the process of turning a SIF into CML, and all of that is supported in CML, but you'll see that there's a lot of steps. We have to support the workflow for that, and that workflow is all supported in XML. So if you have a workflow task, then turning it into XML is of enormous value. And the next slide simply tells you some of the benefits of using XML, all of the W3C tools that you now have available. So by turning something into CML, you don't lose the original SIF, you enhance it with XML, but it interoperates with all these other XML languages like MathML for the mass, SVG for the graphics, Animal for the analytical chemistry. A word about dictionaries now under DICT. The dictionaries serve the purpose of adding the semantics and the ontology to the pure XML. So in yellow, you have a definition of melting point in an instance of a document. It's a scalar with a particular value, 120. But you can see that we can interpret the role of the melting point by linking it to a dictionary. And the dictionary here has an entry for melting point, which would explain what it was, what type the data was, and so forth. And similarly, we have units, and those units are bound into a units dictionary. And we see a multiplicity of dictionaries in XML, which then help to mark up the XML data. Now again, this isn't a new idea. This has been developed, it's been completely borrowed from the International Union of Crystallography, for whom we thank for this vision. But the XML makes it enormously easier to support than if it's in proprietary languages. Come on to DICT 11. DICT 1.1 shows how a document on the right, the pink beastie, has instances of objects with a dictionary reference, and we can link through to the dictionary, and this shows that there are two examples of density here, one of boiling point, one of melting point, linked back to the dictionary. And DICT 2 shows how we can have more than one dictionary, and here, for example, we might have two different types of density. One might be a volumetric density, the other might be an electron density. And the job cont, we show how XML can revolutionize the management of computational chemistry, and we have processed a million jobs through systems of this sort. And the blue shows how by wrapping stuff in XML, we can automate the process of computational chemistry. And the next slide, Mopac Glue, shows how we can manage that SIF operation that we talked about by chaining them through XML. We start with red, which is SIF. We turn it into the blue XML, do all the process in XML, and then at the send it into the legacy tool Mopac, and then convert it back again into XML where we archive it. And the whole of this gives rise to what we call a datument, next slide, which is a seamless integration of document and data. And thereby, we would urge publishers to make sure that their publications do in fact honor the data in the publications as well as the free text. Let me finish by saying something about peer-to-peer, P2P1, which we see as a key new idea for chemistry, that if you make your data publicly available, then people can share it. We have the technology for it. All we need now is the will. Something about the future here, what we're doing in the future. And finally, under thanks, let me thank a very large number of people who've contributed to this open approach. Industry, publishers, and a large number of open source players. And to finish by saying that there are many more links on our website, and we will direct you to them through the URLs which you can see in this talk. And thank you for inviting me.